I'm Dan Smolin, and this is the Dan Smolin Podcast. We help people to navigate the future of work, to work that is profound, protects the planet, empowers people and communities, and is fun to do, meaningful work. The stories that our guests tell and the insights that they provide will inspire you to connect with work and experiences that stoke your passions and make the world a better place. For the future of work is meaningful work. It is the week before Christmas 2020, and may I take this opportunity to wish happy holidays to you all. On Monday, December 14, drug company Pfizer began distribution of its COVID vaccine to frontline healthcare workers across the United States. That is indeed good news. And yet, our joy is tempered because we are about to ride the biggest and deadliest wave of this pandemic. Most of us have returned to 100% remote work for at least the next several months. All of this has gotten me to think deeply about the central mission of my work, to help you and others find and do work that is profound, protects the planet, empowers people and communities, and is fun to do, meaningful work. And I am especially obsessed with one of the questions that I posed back in 2017 to labor historian and professor at Morgan State University, David Jacobs. I asked him, what does it mean to work? Listening to my conversation with Professor Jacobs, I was struck by how the work challenges back then remain with us today. We cover a lot of ground in a discussion about what it means to work, the struggles that we who work endure, the importance of corporate reputation and social responsibility in the companies and organizations we join, and much more. I spoke with Professor David Jacobs in late April 2017 over Skype. So, one of the areas that seems to remain underreported in the news that plays out often in daily discussions that I have as a recruiter has to do with the state of the workforce and the radical changes that the workforce has experienced. And of course, if you go back several generations, how one got into the workforce was kind of binary. Through getting accreditation with a college degree, perhaps you ended up in a white-collar end of the workforce. And if you got some kind of training, perhaps through a union academy, you ended up in a blue-collar end of the workforce. But as we know, and as you know better than most as a labor historian and as an educator, things really have devolved. And I was wondering if you could help describe some of the changes that have impacted our workforce and what it now means to work.
Okay, I think it's important to note that there are different stages and periods in the evolution of work. That is to say, there was a system that kind of evolved in the 30s and 40s that was somewhat new. And it was in that context that there were many industries and professions in which people found job security. It hadn't always been the case that organizations had worked that way. But through a combination of union pressure, regulation, and some understanding on the part of managers, organizations came to realize that it was valuable to have some continuity among their members. They decided that they could make a bargain, offer employees maybe a little more in the way of pay, and some due process, and the employees would respond by a level of commitment. So that emerged in the unionized sector, in the public sector, in the professions, in some companies that got to it on their own. But that wasn't the entire workforce. There is still in the margins the more traditional, the more old-fashioned drive system, as Richard Edwards used to put it, in which people were just sort of in and out the door quite casually, not really in a committed employment relationship. So the system that we think about as the one that's gone was brought into being in the 30s and 40s. Mm-hmm. For a significant number of workers, they had a career, a promotional pattern, higher wages. They knew where they were going. They stayed there. And then, of course, in the 80s, it began to fall apart, or maybe the 70s, in manufacturing. And later that kind of deterioration spread to other industries outside of manufacturing.
In your book, The Disunited States of America, Employment Relations Systems in Conflict, you talk about labor capitalism. I'm wondering if you could talk more deeply about the setbacks that have affected the workforce.
A lot of people thought it was a good idea to have a kind of capitalism in which organizations offered that social contract to workers, employees perceived the possibility of promotion from within, the various due process systems were in place. And that's what an economist named Schumpeter called it. He called it laborist capitalism. He didn't like it because he didn't think it was good enough for entrepreneurs. It wasn't changing enough. It was too rigid. But it did provide rising incomes, the possibility of household ownership, access to education, all those sorts of things for a good number of people in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and 70s. So we began to get in the 80s the idea that organizations had to change. They should become more participatory, more employee involvement. And for a while, it seemed like that was going to add to the mix, add a new dimension that would be fine to incorporate into laborist capitalism. That is to say, it would be the same decent wages and benefits, but now with participation, more democratic workplaces. But that appears to have been a short-term vision that some people had, and very rapidly organizations began to discover the virtues of downsizing, at least from the Wall Street perspective. Right. And said organizations were hollowing out or disintermediating or changing form, but whatever you call it, there was a smaller space available for career progression. I found lots of textbooks that celebrated the opportunities in that transition, emphasizing how we could all be our own entrepreneurs, which has some value to it, but we're entrepreneurs competing with one another, and there's not unlimited support for all of us to make our way in that competitive environment.
So we have this environment now, and it's not just enough to consider getting accredited or getting trained and then getting a job and having full-time employment. Now we have a door number two or a door number three, which could be I leave my college experience, perhaps I become an entrepreneur, or perhaps because I can't find full-time work, I just piece together some gigs. At the end of the year, collect up my 1099s, file my taxes, and that's it. But I'm still responsible for my own health care and benefits. What has that done from a macro labor standpoint, both positively and negatively?
Well, I think it's contributed to the erosion of job security and wages everywhere. The fact that people have to move in this direction, we have competition with these cost-conscious, disintermediated things that compete with traditional enterprise. It's driving down wages. Now, there are some people who can negotiate a way through this and hope to find the next oasis, hope to find the next space where they can be comfortable and develop in a variety of ways. So if you can find one anchor, one particular contract that offers significant compensation, and then you're very constructive and strategic about how you spend the income you get from that, you realize that you're investing in yourself and you're creating your own benefit structure. You're trying to sustain, to create a lot of flows, money coming in from multiple sources, but at least one has to be reliable and significant. If you can manage things, you can enjoy the freedom that that provides, but it's you're on a kind of a narrow margin there. You have to really figure things out. Now, I discovered this through my daughter's experience, one daughter who has been in New York City, and her first jobs were almost entirely part-time, limited benefits or no benefits. And, of course, she needed a lot of help. Young people starting out in that context need lots of help. They need guidance and income support from their parents when it's possible. Now she's found something which is more traditional in terms of offering benefits and income. So she managed to get from point A to point B. But if you can find the one anchor that gives you the security and income support that you probably won't get from others, and you have income that's variable, then you have to do the planning for yourself and create your own organization for security.
So let's talk about that. When I entered the workforce in the early 1980s, I associated full-time employment with security and trajectory. I did this and I can scale my career, and everything else is considered too risky to do. Go off and try to start a business and be an entrepreneur. I didn't even think of that. I thought about what was going to help me scale my career most effectively and perhaps in the safest manner possible. But I think that a lot of people nowadays who are leaving the college environment, that safety net just doesn't exist anymore. A full-time job and a career that you want may not be evident immediately. You might have to piece together some gigs, but we don't make it easy for people to do that. How do we make it easy? What do we need to do with the stakeholders at the table, such as business, government, and academia, to make all that happen? To make, for instance, benefits portable? What do we need to do, David?
Well, obviously, one thing that you have to do is keep and improve the Affordable Care Act, since that's a significant impetus to entrepreneurship. People are able to go out on their own, and they don't have to lose health insurance. There's a way for them to fund health insurance. The repeal and replacement of the Affordable Care Act would be a peril for people in that position. It's also possible to tinker with the unemployment insurance system so that if people have prior work experience, prior credits to the unemployment insurance system, that they can get some income to help them start their careers out of that system. There are ways to leverage it to promote entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. We could have an entire public policy system in which the goal was to give people the equivalent of 40 acres and a mule, give them the capital to start their businesses. We could make it easier to do that, but that's not happening. We have neither movement in that direction to provide portable benefits or special income protections for the entrepreneur, nor do we have security in the old-fashioned social insurance system. There's so much challenge everywhere that it becomes primarily the responsibility of the individual to fashion something for himself or herself. It might be, though, that in specific cities and states and professions that there's some imaginative solutions arising. We have the experience of construction and the arts, the performing arts, where we've had short-term projects. Mm. We've had individuals and small businesses starting up, doing some work, and then going someplace else. We have historical models for a system that maximizes security as well as maximizing entrepreneurship. So it might be that in certain cities where workers are well organized and there are a lot of innovators and professionals who are saying we need this kind of system to enhance entrepreneurship, it might be that there are some public policy supports emerging there. What we'll probably find, given that the federal government is pulling out of support for working people in so many ways, it'll be cities and states that come up with new models, new laboratories of experimentation. I hope somewhere there's something really creative happens, that we find a robust, creative entrepreneurial sector emerging in New York City and San Francisco and all kinds of places where people are prepared to bring government and private sector together.
In a way, you've described a Confederate existence in our future, one where if I want that kind of freedom or that kind of support, I may have to go to a northern state.
I have been thinking along these lines for a while. I don't want to overemphasize the certainty of this, but I think in a sense we are moving toward an era of networks, but not the way the business consultants usually describe it. That is to say, the government itself, the federal government, is not going to be on the side of the majority of people, if I can put it that way. And it'll be a kind of polarization of options on the local and state level in which some people find security and possibility. When I say networks, it's the networks of professions and communities and cities doing creative stuff, not the federal government that most of us used to turn to as a source of hope and advancement. It may mean that we have to imagine, visualize, moving from city to city in this country or to other countries to find the fertile ground for pursuing the kinds of professions we want for ourselves, since we're not going to find a level playing field across the country but instead pockets where good stuff is happening and pockets where bad stuff is happening. That puts it starkly.
I was going to use the term scary, but you said starkly. That's fine too. So you are in a classroom teaching students at Morgan State University. I would imagine that the students are disproportionately late millennial and early Gen Z. As cohorts, they can value purposefulness over a paycheck. I'm seeing this with companies that the people in the workforce that are most valued are the ones that seek to work for companies that stand for something positive. Maybe it's how they handle corporate social responsibility and sustainability. How does that rise to the level with people like your students, but also in the workforce culture that we have right now?
My students have the traditional goals as well as the more contemporary goals you're describing. They're worried about not making enough income. They want to make a good income if they can. And they also want to feel space to have families and to be creative. So they want everything, and they're not really sure what they're going to get. So they recognize that some industries have been more open to them than others. So they have family members, relatives who have discovered good work in some of the major firms in Baltimore, or they've discovered good work with the government. And one of the criteria for them is whether there's history of minority advancement in those enterprises.
Right.
But they want to feel that their efforts and their talents will be rewarded. And they haven't developed the skills to know from the outset what companies will in fact be the most helpful. They can't see inside the companies. So basically what happens here, I think, is that a lot of the networks of alumni begin to help by showing the path forward. And the alumni networks also have the advantage, have the feature of being interested, because these are students, former students who like the school, like Baltimore. They want to be sure that the people they recruit will have opportunity to advance and will have as much as a career as they can have. So it's kind of the networks within the companies that are critical in identifying talent and making sure there's an opportunity for advancement. And in that way, those networks of graduates are trying to open the space and clear the some of the vegetation and provide for advancement. So a company that already recognizes its Morgan graduates and has already given them a good chance to move forward, it's those companies that look positive from the outside for Morgan students.
So it's not like other institutions where purpose can drive the job search. There's also a safety and security driver.
Yeah, and it's connected to identity and networks. So I think that's an important factor, I think. And the fact that there are people with whom one can identify in these companies, some of which are local, is what persuades the Morgan graduate that they can have some confidence in their opportunities there. So it breaks through the rhetoric. Lots of companies, one thing that's important that I see from my perspective as an academic is that rhetorical commitments to corporate social responsibility and to sustainability are quite common.
Mm-hmm.
Companies are becoming very clever about the way in which they use that kind of language. So what matters to students here, I think, is a reality of opportunity that the language doesn't demonstrate. It's actually the experience of graduates that tells them that there is opportunity. I wouldn't say that, not a lot of them talk about, it's not the primary concern, they don't talk about the environment as their primary concern, but if you push them further, they'll say, of course, we want a company that's greener and sustainable. First question is, can I get in and will I be able to survive for a while?
For our listeners' sake, but also to add a little context, I was wondering if you could tell me about the composition of your classroom. Where do your students come from? And what's their experience like?
Morgan State University is an HBCU. It's an historically black college.
Uh-huh.
It's in Baltimore. And many of the students are first-generation college students. Many of them come from Baltimore or Maryland or the Mid-Atlantic. But we also have a significant global population of students. What's interesting about Morgan is that it has a very wide range of qualification and talent. It has students who didn't get lots of examples of relatives who were in college, so they're just discovering the stuff on their own, compared to students who already have had lots of relatives in college and are already pretty sophisticated academics. And we have a PhD program as well as a master's program. So it's an old-fashioned public university where every level of skill is that can be imagined is present. That's exciting because it means that I don't have that narrow group to deal with, but I have to figure out how to address and reach students with very different sorts of goals.
What keeps them up at night? I would imagine that they are anxious about their futures, but are there things that you hear in the classroom that are bothersome to them?
Well, some of them, you know, already have felt economic insecurity and want finally to be liberated from that. They're not unique in that. I mean, I see my daughter struggling with that in New York City. So it's part of the horizon that you are thrown for a loop in a way, and you have to figure out how to come back and make your life better. So they have that hunger and fear about getting that first job and hoping that it really means something.
I'm wondering if we could take a step back to an essay that you wrote, which you called Corporate Social Responsibility and Labor Policy in the Disunited States of America. And you wrote this, and I quote, "Many business and society scholars seek to describe, and sometimes to advance, the corporate social responsibility at the expense of a deeper understanding of its fragile and contradictory nature," end quote. What does that mean, David? And would you provide some examples of how this plays out?
I meant that a number of academics in the business society field were telling a good story, a story of progress in all fronts, a story of companies that were all moving quite consistently in a good direction, in which you find greater environmental concern, greater concern for employees. All those things were happening at the same time. And some of them were not looking very closely at what was actually happening in those companies. That, to give you one very narrow example, we celebrated the decision of McDonald's in the 1990s to drop plastic packaging and move to paper packaging that was recycling. And they did that in the U.S., but not elsewhere. It was a decision focused on the pressure in the U.S. And it was significant. It was an example of negotiation with stakeholders. It was a good thing, but it was a moment, and it was not accompanied by lots of other changes at McDonald's. Maybe more stuff is happening now. But what happens is that a company gets a lot of praise for one stream of activity, which in and of itself is not that significant and may be accompanied by lots of stuff that is rather regressive in terms of treatment of employees or other kinds of environmental concerns. So it seemed that some of the scholars were being good PR hands for the corporations and not really helping distinguish insignificant moments from more substantial progress. Become increasingly convinced of the power of rhetoric to overcome the lack of reality in a particular area. Now, there are companies and organizations that are doing good stuff that's real. But if the people who are writing about it don't distinguish between the real from the unreal, then of course it's harder for us to see and to celebrate the real good things that are happening.
How important will corporate social responsibility be from the standpoint of labor?
I think there will be a few companies that are able to discover on their own, once again, sort of recover the knowledge that a community of employees has advantages for everyone. That is to say, there can be higher quality products, there can be a better relationship with the community. If you treat the organization and you treat the employees well, give them a sense of stake and commitment. Some companies are going to rediscover that. But, and it will be in particular in cities and states where that kind of vision is in the air. But there will be a lot of regression as well, given the deterioration, the lack of enforcement of labor law, which makes it too easy for companies to cut corners. So it means for the individual seeking work, seeking rewarding work, fulfilling work, he or she will have to be more discerning than ever in finding the places and spaces where there is real opportunity and craft available. So it's going to be a little bit harder to find those jobs. But the fact is, if organizations rediscover the value of reciprocity, of treating people as they should be treated, then we can rebuild the losses. We can rebuild from the losses that we've had.
I have to imagine that reputation will play a significant role in this. In the past couple of weeks, we watched and discussed what has happened to the United States. A paying customer, somebody who had a ticket and a boarding pass, was yanked from their seat on a United Airlines flight. He lost teeth and suffered a concussion. The passenger now requires reconstructive surgery for the injury suffered. The reputational damage that has been caused this brand is significant. I have to imagine that there may be a power in that of talent who are discerning, really looking at reputation and asking themselves, do I want to work for this company? And to that, I want to add some further context. Early in my career, I worked at an ad agency that had a tobacco company as a client. It was my client. And I accepted that fact, and they paid me a lot of money to service that client. And I guess that I may have deluded myself thinking, well, I'm not encouraging non-smokers or children to smoke. But today, offered that same opportunity, I probably would have declined. You know, my values are different now. And so I ask, will we get to a point of force multiplication whereby companies with the best social values get the best people and good companies win?
Well, we have to help that. I don't think it'll happen organically. That is to say, now that we've seen that United and American Airlines have made some serious errors and they probably have some built-in deficits in their consciousness of certain things, there are other airlines that behave differently. I guess it's the job of journalists and scholars and consultants to point out that maybe, based upon my experience, an airline like Southwest functions differently. And it's not perfect, but compared to United and American, they've learned that there's value in humor and consideration, things that United doesn't understand. So if we can illuminate those sorts of differences and encourage them, if Southwest and the similar enterprises get sufficient attention and are held accountable for their prior commitments of, so that they continue doing that, then we, in fact, may be expanding the pool of better companies.
Where do you think that the workforce is headed? And what do you think that the future of work is going to look like?
I think there, I always have a worst case scenario and a positive scenario. I'm going to mention the positive for the moment, okay, rather than the worst case. And I think it is possible that the public policy changes and some of the misbehavior of certain corporations will lead to a response, and more people will recognize that sort of amoral, unconstrained profit maximizing isn't the best model for the community or for the organization itself. It may be that we will rediscover some lessons we've learned, and many of us will work very hard to build better institutions. So I'm hoping that seeing in some sense that we're going back to square one or rock bottom will inspire some creative thinking and some careful construction of a better world of business.
I want to ask you about something that I've noticed in my line of work, and that is the emergence of what I call a worker activist. I'm not talking about a worker who is a union member necessarily. I'm talking about somebody who is at a point of not necessarily rage, but of great discomfort. And such a worker activist may take to the streets because she is concerned about her job at the EPA and is willing to fight for it by protesting, or perhaps taking issue with her company's investment portfolio, which is steeped in old energy holdings. Do you think what I'm noticing may be catching on?
I think that the rogue tweeting may be a symptom of something larger. That does, in fact, mean that people in organizations and agencies are worried about the direction of their organizations and willing to communicate something about this. They're blowing some whistles, and that might be a sign of less not less merely accepting, less acceptance of what's going on, and more resistant. So that would be a significant phenomenon if everywhere we looked, we found a few people showing some courage and challenging the stuff that they find very worrisome. The whole, I think, rogue tweeting may become part of a larger movement. Now, the question is whether that begins to cause organizations to change, and whether it leads to some new kind of organizations, new communities in which people are talking about better workplaces. It might. Mm-hmm. It might if people in different places remain in contact and share ideas about what a good organization might look like. I want more people to read the Disunited States of America, certainly.
But describe that for us, because we didn't talk about the published piece.
It's a review volume. It's a series of articles about various dimensions of labor policy across the country. And the main idea you get from it is that the country is not uniform in terms of the way business operates, rights and protections workers have, and it may be, in fact, going in polarized directions. It's about, in part, the decline of laborist capitalism, the dangers to people seeking work, how it is that organizations are kind of falling apart and laws are no longer very effective. But at the same time, at the very end of the book, this is, I mean, I wrote two chapters and there are contributions from a number of scholars and practitioners who understand income support, health insurance, other aspects of employment across the board. But at the very end, I suggest that what I would like to see is an economy in which craft becomes central. Old ideas of craft in which people can be identified with and committed to the work that they do and derive satisfaction from it. We could build organizations around craft rather than around brands or around profits, but around actually doing good and doing creative stuff.
And I gather that we can find it on Amazon.com and other venues?
Yeah, and it's connected to identity and networks.
I see.
So I think that's an important factor, I think. And the fact that there are people with whom one can identify in these companies, some of which are local, is what persuades the Morgan graduate that they can have some confidence in their opportunities there. So it breaks through the rhetoric. Lots of companies, one thing that's important that I see from my perspective as an academic is that rhetorical commitments to corporate social responsibility and to sustainability are quite common. Mm-hmm. Companies are becoming very clever about the way in which they use that kind of language. So what matters to students here, I think, is a reality of opportunity that the language doesn't demonstrate. It's actually the experience of graduates that tells them that there is opportunity. I wouldn't say not a lot of them talk about, it's not the primary concern. They don't talk about the environment as their primary concern. But if you push them further, they'll say, of course, we want a company that's greener and sustainable. First question is, can I get in and will I be able to survive for a while?
David Jacobs, thank you for joining us on the podcast.
I very much enjoyed it. Thank you very much, Dan.
A link to Professor David Jacobs' book is provided in the show notes for this episode at dansmolin.com. Please join us again for more inspiring stories from people who are real-time reimagining the work that we do and hope to do. You can subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts by keywording the Dan Smolin Podcast or listen to current and past episodes on our website at dansmolin.com. I'm Dan Smolin, and this is the Dan Smolin Podcast. Thank you for joining us on an amazing journey to the future of work, doing meaningful work. And do remember this, our best days lie ahead. Let's connect again next week.